Hi, my name's June. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I really want to thank you for inviting me here and allowing me to be part of your conference. I really want to thank Mike for the phone calls and the letters and the cards. It's really been a special privilege to get to know him a little bit better, and I really appreciated that. And it's very special to be able to be here and spend a little time with Jack, because we go way, way back. I also have the privilege of sponsoring one woman who lives in Texas, and it's her AA anniversary today. So it was pretty neat that I would end up getting invited to be in Texas on that particular date. And so for all of those reasons, I thank you for allowing me to be part of your conference. I'm going to start out by saying those things that I consider to be the most important, just in case the people here are like I was and am sometimes still today, as far as not being able to focus for very long. So I can, if I start with the important things, then I can get that out of the way. I guess the first thing, in keeping with the tradition of Texas Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll give you my sobriety date, which is July the 13th, 1972. I live a life today that I never would have wanted, and I am a person today that I wouldn't have even liked when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet, for the most part, most of the time, I'm happier than I have ever been. So Alcoholics Anonymous is still filled with a lot of mystery for me, how it has worked and how things have unfolded in my life have often been a surprise to me, and in a way that's a comfort when I come up upon a dark path and I'm not sure what the hell is coming down the road. Sometimes those things have just, since I've been through them in the years of sobriety, I've seen the way that things can oftentimes work out, and I don't have quite as much fear sometimes. I want to start out by saying, particularly for those of you who might be new to Alcoholics Anonymous or new to a conference, that I'm not an expert on alcoholism or on Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been asked to stand up here for a little while and share with you, as it suggests that we do in the book, a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today, and that's what I'll try to do while I'm here. Strongly encourage you to go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous before you make a decision about whether this is a place for you, because there's all different kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that that's one of the most spiritual things about Alcoholics Anonymous, is when it says in the book that we are people who normally would not mix. And those people who have added the most to my life over the years have been the people that I oftentimes would never have imagined myself having anything to do with. I want to let you know, too, that I'm not paid to stand up here and talk, nor is anyone paid in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to know that for a couple of reasons. One, because after the meeting, if you're sitting at coffee, you know, I don't want you sitting around saying, they had to pay her for that, you know, so I don't want to get into that kind of a thing, you know. But the main reason that I'd like you to know that, especially if you are new or not familiar with the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I want you to know that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not been free, I never could have come here. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not remained free, I never could have stayed. I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I was able to put a dollar in the basket for the seventh tradition on anything like a regular basis. So this is not about money, and that's important to me that I remember to pass that on to you. I'm one of those people that believes I was born an alcoholic, and I don't want to have a philosophical discussion about that with anyone after the meeting. It's just what I believe. And I believe that because there was something wrong with me long before I ever started to drink or use the chemicals that I was to mix with alcohol. And my first obsession in life was not alcohol and drinking. My first obsession in life was suicide. And from as far back as I can remember, which is about 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. And I used to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades. I used to take overdoses of baby aspirin, which is all I knew about at the time. I used to beat my hands and face and body with a hammer. I used to burn my body in a lot of different places and ways. And I did a lot of things to try and hurt myself, and mostly to try to die. And, you know, in the years that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have certainly recognized that I have a capacity for being a bit dramatic. But, you know, up to and including today, as I look back on my life before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to tell you that, being as rigorously honest as I can be, I truly wanted to die. I can see that some of my suicide attempts were to get a little bit of attention, but I really, really, really wanted to die. And I know, again, that if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you may not identify with that, or certainly you may not identify with any of those kind of feelings until you came to the end of your drinking. And that's why I encourage you to go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we all have a lot of different paths as far as getting here. I've never had a social drink in my life, nor have I ever wanted one. I have never not gotten drunk. I have never not overdosed. That's all that I know. And so, you know, if you drank the way that I did and you mixed it with the kind of chemicals that I did, which were always downers or reds or yellows or barbiturates or whatever you might know them as, then you don't have a very exciting drunkalogue either. You know, I've thrown up a lot, I've overdosed a lot, and that's really about all I did before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so for me, I did not have a lot of fun years drinking. But what alcohol did for me was it didn't make me feel good. It just helped me to not feel at all. And thank God it did that. I started to use drugs at 7 years old. I began to drink on a regular basis at 8 years old. And by the time I was 9, I found that combination that I never altered in any way, which was the barbiturates and the alcohol, because the combined effect of those got me exactly where I needed to go. And that was out. I didn't have to experiment any further. It just worked perfectly well. And in between times, I tried to kill myself. But I truly believe that I would have been locked up in a mental institution. I don't see any way that I could possibly have remained out in the world had it not been for alcohol. And so I'm extremely grateful that I had that it worked for me the way that it did. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I knew a lot about alcoholism. You know, because of that, there was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of different kinds of abuse. There was a lot of broken promises. There were a lot of the same things going on in my home as went on in a lot of other alcoholic homes. I did not see alcoholism as a disease. I just saw it as a weakness. And in my life, before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and actually after, in fact, one of the most difficult things, old ideas that I've had to work through, are those things that I was to decide were weaknesses. And I decided that my mother was weak, and I never forgave her for it. And when I was about 5 years old and my memory, you know, basically starts, I went off to school, I guess like a lot of other people do at five, and I can remember, you know, I used to be able to remember with perfect clarity. It's no longer that important to me because I'm busy now. But I used to be able to remember with perfect clarity the names that the kids called me and what they were wearing and what I was wearing and just how much it hurt, and relive that experience just completely. Because at 5 years old, when I went out into the world and those kids teased me about being tall and being skinny and having curly red hair and being in the family that I was in and where I came from and those things, I felt like I was being cut up inside with knives. And sometimes I would actually start to cry. And so I found out about myself from my earliest recollection that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world. I was weak. And I never forgave myself for it. And the only thing that gave me some relief from that feeling of being weak was alcohol. Because I didn't have to feel anything at all. And I didn't feel weak then. I could control my emotions. And that was probably the number one thing that I wanted to be able to do in my life. In growing up in this alcoholic home, I know today that most of the people that I was looking at around me were alcoholics. But I didn't know that then. Before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not ever remember seeing a man cry under any circumstances. I've seen men stabbed. I've seen them shot. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen a lot of different things happen in their lives. I never saw a man shed a tear under any of those circumstances. I saw the women in my life go through each and every one of those circumstances as well. Some of them didn't cry, but most of them did at one point or another. They seemed to have a breaking point. And I looked at those two different groups of people very carefully, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my whole life trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, they never let anyone know it. And the only exception to that was anger and rage were okay. And that's all I thought men ever felt, and that's all I wanted to be able to feel. And again, alcohol allowed me to have the kind of control so that I was able to live like that. When I was a little kid, and they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said, a boy. Wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. But it was really what I wanted. And my family began to realize that I wasn't just kidding about that. It wasn't like one day a nurse and one day a boy. It was like, no, just a boy, you know. And so they began to take me, my family is and was very active in the Catholic Church, and they began to take me to different priests for counseling about this desire that I had to be a boy. And somewhere in that time, or not too long after, we were on welfare. And possibly through one of the priests, I don't know, but my mom learned that we were entitled to, that I was allowed to go see a psychiatrist and psychologist, and I began to see these people as well. You know, I really can't tell you why the psychiatrists, thought that I wanted to be a boy, or why I tried to kill myself, or why I cut myself up or hurt myself, or any of these things, because I felt about psychiatrists and psychologists just like my friend Patty Hicks always did. I thought they should have to work for their money. And and so I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I never filled out one form. I never played with one doll. I had nothing to say to these people. And I would sit there the required period of time, and then I would leave. So I wasn't really able to get help, even if it had been available that way. Anyway, somewhere along the line, I guess I learned that I was my first lesson in acceptance, that I wasn't going to be able to be a boy. And so the way that I saw the world, which certainly, as we all know, doesn't mean that it was the way that the world was, but the way that I saw the world, the only option for someone like me was to try and be a tough broad. And so I spent all my time before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a number of years after trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. And I grew up in a town in Los Angeles called Venice. It's a beach town. It's a very interesting town, and I fit right in. I hardly stood out at all. In Venice, because it's a beach town, maybe. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's just my own experience, strength, and hope. I've traveled around the country. I've met a lot of other tough broads, and there do seem to be some geographic requirements that kind of, you know, alter how you act and what you do. But being a beach town, it was very important that you have tough feet, so you don't wear shoes. So that was it for shoes. And it was important at that time, to me anyway, to be a tough bride, that you be in a gang, and I was. It was important that you do a lot of fighting, and I did. It's important that I remember to let you know tonight that I've never won a fight in my life. But my ego still wants me to let you know that I have never fought less than five people at a time. And my sponsor was able to explain that to me after I got sober. You know, if you fight one person and you lose, someone might think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fight groups of five or more, then they think, hey, she must be pretty tough, or why would that many people have to jump her? You know, so you have this chance. And I walked around with my with a swollen lip and a black eye and my face, you know, beaten up a lot. But it was a small price to pay, you know, for that chance that someone might think I was a tough broad. Obviously, I never convinced the most important person, that being myself. But I was willing to go to any lengths. I mean, you know, at the time, tattoos weren't particularly popular. Back then, they were a little bit, but not, you know, not as they have come into age these days. And I'm kind of grateful nowadays, because I, you know, I would have probably gotten something, you know, like a shark that would swim on my arm when I did this, something like that. I don't know. Hey, I would have thought of something interesting, born to die or something, you know. Anyway, I would stand down on the boardwalk with my gang, looking tough, and we would be smoking, and I'd see some touristy-looking people. And I would take my cigarette, and I would throw it down on the sidewalk, and I would put it out with my bare feet. And I would see these touristy-looking people kind of stare at one another, and then they'd whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, wow. That is one tough broad. And I was very impressed that I could do this, and I was sure that they were too. Again, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained that perhaps what some of those people were saying to one another was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid?" But I didn't know there was another way of looking at it. Those were the kind of things that kept me busy before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother. My mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for many years at the time, with varying lengths of sobriety. And she brought me to that meeting that night, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because I admitted having a problem, but simply because she thought that I might get her evicted from another apartment if she left me alone. And I went to the meeting, and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me that night, even though I didn't get sober. And it began because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And I did not admire very many people. I had my standards, and I was very strict about them. But I admired this guy. And again, if you're new, you may not, or been around a while, I mean, you may not identify with the things that kept me coming back, but it's important that I share them, I think. I admired this man because he was from Venice. He was from my hometown. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. And he'd been in jail. He'd been in prison. He had a tattoo. He rode a motorcycle. He had a knife and had it with him at the meeting that night. And I looked at him and I just thought, wow, I did not think that people this tough came to AA. You know, I thought it was just for weak people like my mom. And so I was very impressed that somebody this tough would be in a meeting. Also, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. And when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens, you know. But that was what I wanted out of life. And this guy, Paul, when he'd been drinking, if he wanted to have your table, you just gave him the whole table. I mean, you just didn't even discuss it because you didn't know what Paul was going to do to get the table, you know. And so I looked at this guy, and he had the ability to clear rooms and tables, everything that I wanted out of life. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not raise my hand because I was not an alcoholic. And even if I had been, I wasn't going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So I just went to these meetings, and in between the meetings, I talked to Paul. He was the only person that I considered cool enough for me to talk to here. And I explained to Paul in between the meetings that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had people to see, places to go, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I was clearly not alcoholic. I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. You know, they already know that. But Paul turned to me and he said, "You know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing. And they've told me that I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own." He said, "But in your case, I'm going to make an exception." He said, "I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals. And I happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass." And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up a story about something he'd heard or read about or something like a high school teacher might do to scare the kids. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in my life. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that two-week period of time, as I went to those meetings not raising my hand, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I was living with my mother at that time. By the time I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother was myself. And my mother being the alcoholic in my life, I blamed her for everything that had ever gone wrong. And take it from me, the short version, a lot had gone wrong. So I had a lot of things, you know, that were going on here. And because of the kind of person that I was and because of the amount of anger and hate that I carried with me at all times, I used to attack my mother physically. And because my mother was getting sober at this time, she didn't think she had to be subjected to attacks in her own apartment, and she asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family had not talked to me in a couple of years, and I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and I didn't bother trying. I'd been in a number of foster homes. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some alcohol recovery and drug rehab houses that were in the L.A. area at that time. There were not that many, really, but none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. I tried to get into a program back then called Synanon that was basically desperate for membership. It was starting to go underground, and they wouldn't take me either. So things were really starting to look pretty bad. One day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn them if I'd had them, but I didn't have any shoes. I had no family. I had no friends. I had no place to live. I had no money. And so I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see where it was kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? I mean, it was, you know, just very easy. And when I raised my hand in that meeting, those meetings, I know today that there were some people there who did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I know that some of those people did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous is because when I did begin to raise my hand, some of those people knew because of my mother's membership how old I was, and they came over to me and they told me that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they'd get together and throw me out. And I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't do that. I just figured AA didn't want me either. And that was okay with me, because I didn't want me either. And I hadn't for a really long time. And I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her house. I found the bathroom, and I looked for the kind of pills that I needed to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it one more time. And before I passed out that day, I ended up going, "Wah! This is interesting. Hey, that'll be fun." Anyway, ended up going to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to that meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit. Now, I don't know where you guys go to meetings here in Texas, but where I got sober in West Los Angeles, they almost never called on anybody's share who was laying in the meeting. But they called on me that day, and I certainly don't know what I said. I know they realized I needed to be in a hospital, and that was where I woke up, with the doctor giving me medication, explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart, and had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably could not have brought me out of. And I really can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the others that I'd inflicted upon myself up to that point. I just know that it was. Because since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. And that's how I personally define sobriety. You know, I realized at that time, and I've known this ever since, you know, that I am not one of those people that stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of going back out there on the streets and dying. I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there. What scared me and has kept me sober many times is the thought that maybe I could go back out there and continue to live the way that I was living for another 20 or 30 or 40 years. Because by the time I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not imagine going on breathing in and out two or three more times, hating myself any more than I did. It does not seem possible to me up to and including today. I'm extremely grateful for the people who were here when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and for those old-timers who were here and who tolerated me the way that I was. They were far more tolerant of me than I believe that I am capable of being up to and including today. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a bad attitude. I don't want you to think I got sober and suddenly a bad attitude came upon me. I simply came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and it had always been bad. I did not like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like me, I didn't like my mother, and I didn't like any of the other women around here either. And I didn't want to sit next to women. I didn't want to talk to women. I most certainly was not going to hug or shake hands with women, and I did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. Now, the only men that I had ever known in my life, again, I realized later, were alcoholic, and most of them were extremely violent. And the men here in Alcoholics Anonymous scared me, and I didn't want anything to do with them either. And so I had a problem, because in July of 1972, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all we had here were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. But I went to 21 meetings a week anyway for the first couple of years that I was sober. And I had a commitment at almost every one of those meetings. And my entire life revolved around going to the next meeting and staying until the meeting ended and then cleaning up the meeting so that I could stay as long as possible to be somewhere indoors. And then I would begin to either walk or hitchhike or take a bus or whatever it would take to get to the next meeting so that I could do the setup job so that I would be indoors again. I had no other life. You know, I have to remember sometimes it's difficult. It's been an interesting process of sometimes sponsoring people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, with some semblance of a life, you know, because I didn't have that, you know. And I can remember, you know, like people would say, you know, I'd say, well, you know, you're in your first year, I want you to go to a meeting like every night, you know. I'd say, well, Friday night, it's Dallas, you know. And I'd say, well, great, next time you need a drink, you can call JR. I mean, you know, like, what's that about, you know? I just didn't have a lot of compassion for that, you know. And now I've got, you know, people call me up and they've got to go to the gym, you know. And it was like, Jesus Christ. You know, well, excuse me. I'm sorry. I didn't just think I forgot. Oh, well, that'll give somebody something to pray about. Anyway. Anyway, let's see. I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to the program. It consisted almost solely of profanity, with the exception of a few words like the and mother. And, I found a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were extremely offended by that type of language, and so I tried to use it more when they came near me. I did not wear shoes most of the first couple years that I was sober. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and ankles. I had a motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others," and then split. It was my own little spiritual slogan. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I lit all of them myself. Occasionally, someone would hold a match, and I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with it. And then after I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. I wore T-shirts that had sayings on them that most, if not all, people, including myself today, would find extremely offensive. And what I want to let you know is if you choose to dress the way that I did, to talk the way that I did, and to smoke the way that I did, you too can have sit in a meeting about this size, actually, and have an entire row all to yourself. And so for all of those reasons, I'm extremely grateful that the people of Alcoholics Anonymous were tolerant, and they let me stay here. I can remember I was the greeter at the Westwood meeting. I would stand at the door barefoot, my motorcycle chains and jacket and cigar, welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. And when I got sober, I was 87 pounds, and I had a black eye and a swollen lip, and it took a particularly long time to heal. So I would stand at the door welcoming the newcomers, and sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor whisper, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." So, at that time, people in Alcoholics Anonymous were guessing my age at 37, and I was 13 at the time. But it's been a very interesting last couple of years for me. I just turned 40 this year, and it's so odd to me because, you know, a couple of, you know, my friends or, you know, different people have kind of asked me if I'm, you know, like, scared or, you know, if I've, you know, felt worried or, you know, whatever. And I suppose that that's entirely possible for me as the years come up, you know. But the overwhelming feeling for me is that I don't know that it'll be possible for me to ever, ever feel as old as I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was so old when I got here that I just don't know that it's that there's anything that could get near that. You know, I can't imagine a time when it would. I feel like 1,000 years younger today than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, let's see. Where will we go here? I have a seventh grade education. I dropped out of school. You can see they're not into smoking. They want you to wear shoes, no chains. I mean, there were a lot of problems. The vocabulary thing, you know. And I had dropped out before I got sober, and I just really didn't fit right in. And so that's what allowed me to go to these 21 meetings a week. And my sponsor, who wanted me to go back to school, Gail, you know, she said, look, you know, if you're not going to go back to school, then you're going to get the kind of jobs that people with seventh grade educations get. And that's what I did. And it allowed me to work a lot of strange shifts, you know, graveyard and split shift and different things, swing shift or whatever, so that I was allowed to get to lots of meetings. The fact that Gail became my sponsor is one of those things that always makes me think about the fact that it says in the book, we're people who normally would not mix. Gail was a woman, and I've already mentioned how I felt about that. And I really can't quite, you know, put together how she became my sponsor. The best that I can figure out is that it seemed to me, as I went to these 21 meetings a week, that a woman named Gail Wilson spoke at about 17 of them every week. And so I thought, perhaps if I asked this woman to be my sponsor, I could find out ahead of time where she was speaking, and then I wouldn't have to hear her all the time. And that was the motivation I had for getting a woman for a sponsor. And, you know, Gail became my sponsor, and I confirmed this later, you know, in case you think I'm just being, you know, trying to be funny up here. But Gail became my sponsor because she had been taught to never say no to an AA request. You know, we were just people who normally would not mix. Gail was three times my age at the time. She was from the South, something that I automatically did not like about anyone. Of course, there were so many things that I automatically did not like about people that I really wouldn't even have time to go through it tonight. But suffice it to say, I didn't like anyone in AA. So, you know, you can see that it was a fairly extensive list. But anyway, I didn't like that. She not only did not use the same language I was using, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. She'd come from a warm, loving, supportive family. I really hated people like that. She'd traveled all over the world. You know, I grew up in Venice. I ran away once. I made it 3 miles east to Culver City. So, you know, I didn't really think we had much to go on there. And as if all of that was not bad enough, which in my mind it really was, I mean, she had been seen on numerous occasions in public wearing pink. So something that, you know, I mean, I didn't wear anything pink until I was 10 years sober. You know, I mean, it was a really slow thing for me. So Gail and I, you know, we would meet secretly after meetings. I would see her at my home group, which was her home group, the Thursday night Brentwood workshop. And I'd go over and I'd say hi. And she'd say hi. She'd say, please, don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight. She said, I can't take the cigar smoke. I said, well, that's okay. And I'd turn to walk away and she'd say, in June, please, don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And that was fine with me because I didn't want anyone to know I was hanging out with someone as lame as she was, you know. So we just had this secret, you know, sponsorship relationship. Because of Gail and because of my sponsor and because of my home group at the time, which was the Monday Night Venice group, I'm extremely grateful that I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous in a very, very active group and learned that it was really important to be of service and to show up and to keep your commitments. And, you know, it's been such an interesting thing to me. I do believe that if I had to point to one major thing that was to change my whole attitude and outlook upon life, it really has been those learning things about being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous that were to totally change my life in ways that just don't make any sense up to and including today, and yet they have. Let's see here. When I first came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they would talk about, you know, it's very important to get the big book, sell it for exactly what they paid for it. And they wanted to, you know, they'd say, we'll make liberal credit arrangements, except for the Venice group. They'd say, now, if you're too afraid to talk to somebody about it or something, you can just go ahead and steal it. And I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. So I sort of, you know, thought that might be a good idea. But then I was a little nervous. You know, I didn't want to jinx my sobriety. So instead, I went to the library in Santa Monica, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. You know, I didn't want to make two trips. I didn't have a car. It was very difficult. And, you know, that was just really the best that I could do, you know. And I didn't feel bad about it. I just thought I needed the book, and the library had it, and so I stole it, you know. And after I'd been sober a number of years, I'm not sure exactly how many, maybe four or five, maybe a little bit more than that, I realized that I had to make amends for that. And for the 40 or 50 other library books that I'd stolen throughout my life, great classics like Misty the Seahorse and things like that. So I loaded them up, and I took them down to the librarian in Culver City, and I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that it was necessary for my sobriety to return those books. And I was wondering if maybe I could make payments, because they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for 11 years, you know. And she said, oh, that would be fine. And she said, you know, it's so funny. She said, I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach, and this man came in, and he'd stolen the big book, too. I guess you guys do this all the time. So another one of those lessons of learning, you know, that I'm not unique. Anyway, after I'd been sober for a couple years, Gail found out about this program where I could go to like a trade school, I guess really is what it was, and learn how to be a secretary. And let me just tell you, if there's anything I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. But Gail thought this was important, and so I went. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I typed one day at a time for, I think, 14 months. I'm really not quite sure, but an extremely long period of time. And at the end of that time, I could type 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And they told me I'd never make it as a secretary, which I had known. I mean, I knew that, you know, but I had some other skills. You know, I'd learned about filing and doing some other things. And now it was time to go out and look for a job. And that was the hardest thing I had ever had to do in my sobriety. Up to that point, I was about 2.5, maybe 3 years sober. And I did not want to go out, you know, in the world. I called those people citizen-y type people. And I didn't know very many citizen-y type people. I was very uncomfortable around citizen-y type people. I didn't know how to dress or talk like citizen-y type people. And I certainly knew I wasn't as good as citizen-y type people. But, you know, there were some women on the program that I had become friends with, Patty Hicks, and, you know, she really knew about dressing up and things like that. And I had some other friends, you know, and they would take me to, like, you know, Salvation Army, and they'd give me some of their stuff, and they'd help me dress up and put these clothes on. And, you know, to me, I would dress up for an interview, you know, the way that they told me I should. And I you know, I felt like, look at the little Venice Bride in the citizen costume. You know what I mean? It just didn't feel like it looked right. But I just went out there and I, you know, interviewed, and I got this job in an insurance company. I knew Gail would be thrilled. It was very square. And I went to work, you know, and I worked really, really hard. And on the seventh day, they called me in. I thought they were probably going to, you know, give me a raise and a promotion or something. And they said, I'm sorry. We're going to have to let you go. They said, you don't seem to have enough experience for this job. But she said, but more important than that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I did not know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I went downstairs and I called the L.A. Central office. And I said, hello, this is June G. I'm a sober member. I've just been fired, and what are you going to do about that? And they just kind of laughed like you guys are. You know, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I had been going to meetings for a couple of years at that point. I had never heard. I mean, everybody gets fired when they're drinking. But I didn't think that we would allow things like that to happen here in AA. I mean, I figured we'd pick it or something, you know. And I can remember, you know, I was talking to another, you know, one of my sponsors that night. And I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job. And that took some of the fire out of that. But, you know, that's why sponsors are so important. They can just see things, you know. Anyway, now I had to go out and look for another job, and that certainly didn't help my self-confidence. But I kept trying, and it seemed like I filled out thousands of applications, you know, and this woman called me up one day that I knew from my home group area in Culver City, and, you know, she called me up, and she said, you know, they're interviewing downtown at a bank. I'd never been to downtown. I'd never been in a bank. And she said, you know, let's go down and fill out this, you know, application and see what happens. And I went down and I started to fill out the application. It gets to the part and says, you know, due to the fact that as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check. And I thought, oh, no, I mean, not me. I don't want anyone looking in my past. I mean, first of all, they call one library, and I have had it. You know, I just didn't like the whole thing, you know, but I just kept hearing, you know, people at meetings saying, you know, do the footwork and, you know, leave the results up to God. And so I thought, fine. And I turned in the application and they call me back on a series of interviews at this bank. And I not only got hired to work at a bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know. But I did not steal anything the whole time I worked there. I'm still amazed at that. But anyway, while I was there, I began to take a couple classes at night at a city college. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could read. In other words, I could say the words like in the fifth chapter, but it didn't have any meaning whatsoever. I would read the same sentence over and over and over, and I could not understand what that meant. And I just figured it had a lot to do with some damage that I'd done to my brain, and it probably did. But after I'd been sober for a while, I'd heard about this city college class that they called a dummy English class, and I thought maybe if I took this class, I'd learn how to read again. And so I signed up and I took that class at night. And while I was there, I took a couple of other classes and I just worked full time. And then I went to a couple of these classes and I had another part-time job on the weekends. And by this time, I had found a garage that I was able to rent for $40 a month so that I, you know, could become self-supporting. And that's, you know, that's kind of what was going on for me. And then I ended up getting laid off from the bank. Right when that happened, I applied for a grant at the school so that I could take more classes, and I got a job on campus too, actually, so that I could, you know, continue to work my way through school, and I was able to take more classes, and I continued to do that, and I worked really hard and showed up, and after a couple years there, they called me in the office and they told me that I completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. And I thought that was a nice name for a college degree. I had never wanted a college degree in my life. But I was amazed, you know, that that had happened. And I went on from there. I decided to do the footwork, which is what Gail told me I had to do, because I wanted to go on to a university. And I went ahead and I filled out these applications and I did that footwork. And I was accepted to a university, and I made a decision about which one to go to, and I went on, and then I graduated from there. And again, I was told by Gail I had to do the same footwork as anyone in or out of AA would do to make dreams come true. And I'd come up with this dream, and I don't know where I had it. I don't know if it had it before I got sober and forgot it, or if it came up after I'd been sober. I really don't know. But I went ahead and I did this footwork, and now it's been, gosh, 18 years or something. Maybe 19 years ago that I received a telegram telling me I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'll tell you, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court. but just not on that side of the table. And so I was able to go to law school and to show up. And I had a very difficult time in law school, and it wasn't... It wasn't just that it was hard to study, but it was. But it still it had a lot to do with, you know, the way that I felt about myself. And it's interesting, you know, I heard somebody talk at my home group not all that many years ago. It's so fascinating to me how slow I am to learn, you know, big concepts, you know what I mean? But, you know, like I'm like 20 years sober and I go, oh, you know. So anyway, whatever, you know. And this guy, he was talking at my home group, and he said, you know, my sponsor told me that I was an egomaniac. And he said, you know, an egomaniac is not necessarily someone who thinks well of themselves. It's not even someone who only thinks often of themselves. It's simply someone who thinks only of themselves. And as soon as he said that, I realized that I had always been an egomaniac. I mean, I sat in hundreds and thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for years after I was sober, saying, I'm the ugliest one here, I'm the sickest and more damage, I've hurt more people, I've abused more people, I've sunk lower, no one's ever sunk. I mean, you know, and it's just very hard to get a lot of spiritual information in because I was very busy. You know, and it's just been a really slow process. But there's always been someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that could touch me just a little bit if I sat through the entire meeting, so that I could possibly believe that they too may have had a little bit of pain. Nothing like my pain, okay? But, you know, there's a few people here who they suffered a little bit. You know, after I'd been sober for a while, Gail began to sponsor one of my closest friends today, Linda, and who a number of people here, you know now. But anyway, and Linda is and was one of the most physically beautiful women you have ever seen. And she came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a couple years sober, maybe five. And she asked Gail to be her sponsor. Well, that's fine. I mean, Gail can sponsor whoever she wants, right? Fine. Now, Linda... was blonde and a stewardess who traveled all over the world, who'd been married many times, and there were thousands more who were just waiting for their turn. You know, she came from another warm and loving family. I mean, you know, it just went on and on and on. And Gail says to me, I'd like you to be Linda's friend. I'm like, wait a minute. So she doesn't need a friend. Look at her. You know, I don't want to be her friend. I mean, we have nothing in common. And Gail got a little ticked at me, which she could do sometimes. And she said, you know what? She said, when are you going to realize that it doesn't really matter, you know, whether you're lying in an alley in Venice, or whether you're in a hotel room in Paris, that when you try and kill yourself and when you feel like dying, the feelings are exactly the same. I'm like, really? Because I never really thought about it that way, you know? I mean, I really did not believe that Linda could have had any pain. She didn't look like she had pain. I mean, I looked like I'd had pain, you know? I mean, I worked on that look, you know? I mean... Anyway, today, Linda, who also is one of those people with whom I would normally not mix, is one of my dearest, most special friends. And I'm so grateful that Gail made me be her friend. So through people like Gail and through people like Linda and through a lot of other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still learning the lesson up to the point, you know, when I was in law school, that we are all God's kids. You know, and I believe that to include people who are not in AA as well, which I didn't, you know, for a while. I thought, okay, we are good. They are not good, you know. And that was sort of how I practiced my spiritual program. You know, I mean, I sort of drove like a maniac, cutting people in and out. I'd see an easy dozen cigar. Oh, you can get in. You know, and that was just sort of, you know, but that was as spiritual as I could get for a while. But that was good. You know, I was starting to be aware of others. It's got to start somewhere, you know. But anyway, and so in law school, I was with these people who, whose grandfather had been a lawyer or their grandmother had been a lawyer and their father was a judge and, you know, their mother was, you know, in charge of the state. I mean, just all these things, and I was just very intimidated by all of that. And again, I mean, I can look back and see it was just on how self-centered, you know, I was about where I came from and who I was and, you know, the kind of person that I was. And so around that time is when I really began, you know, again through these friendships that I'd made in Alcoholics Anonymous to really believe that I'm one of God's kids. I think that a lot of the change also had come about through my service work in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I alluded to earlier, which came about sort of in this fashion. I mean, this is the story that I tell, which happened when I was around, I think, 7 years sober. Maybe it was five. I really honestly don't know. I haven't calculated it exactly, but a hell of a long time. Let me just tell you that. It wasn't like 30 days, I'm sorry to say. But it would sound better, I think, if I could say that, especially for newer people. But, you know, I was just... a little bit slow. But anyway, I can remember being at the Palm Springs Roundup, and everybody was all dressed up, and it was the banquet Saturday night. I was looking around, comparing myself to everyone else in the room, which I still do sometimes if I want to feel bad. But anyway, I was doing that, and I looked around, and I thought, you know, I think I saw someone in like a black dress. And I go, hey, isn't that a beautiful dress? I'm like, yeah, it really is. But don't you wish you were wearing that dress? I'm like, no. No, I'm fine. I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress that Patty gave me. I was like, really? I'm like, yeah, this is a really nice brown dress. It's fine. I thought, all right, wait a minute here. What about green? Green's your favorite color, right? I mean, don't you wish you were wearing that green thing over there? It's like, no, you know, I'm really okay wearing this brown dress. It's really okay. All right, wait a minute here. I talked to myself in case you didn't figure that out. But so, okay. All right, so you're okay in the brown dress. Okay, but wait a minute. What about the hair? I mean, wouldn't you rather have blonde hair? No, I guess it's really okay to have red curly hair. You're kidding. And as if, you know, as if that didn't sound like a lot, it totally blew my mind that I wanted to be sitting there with red curly hair, wearing the dress that I was wearing, sitting at the table that I was wearing, at the conference that I was at, not at the fun conference over there, you know, but I mean just right there. A more incredible thing happened to me than I ever believed could happen for someone like me. At that moment, I wanted to feel like I was feeling. I wanted to be living the life that I was living. I didn't wish I had your mother. I didn't wish I came from your town. I didn't wish I had your sponsor. I didn't wish I had your car. I didn't wish I had your job. I didn't wish I had anything different than what was going on in my life right there and then for that moment. And I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was not one person here or all of them put together, and we had some very persuasive members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who could have told me as I stood there in the meetings, you know, as the greeter, not being able to feel like I could breathe in and out two more times, hating myself as much as I did, that someday I would want to be who I was, look how I was, and most of all, feel like I felt. I never had that after I got sober. I never had that when I was, you know, before drinking. I mean, I never had that when I was drinking. I mean, I just didn't feel, but I didn't feel like it was okay to feel like I was feeling, you know. So it was the power of Alcoholics Anonymous being able to accomplish that in my life is still mind-boggling to me. Now, I would love to be able to tell you that from that moment to this, it's always been like that, but that's not true. There's some days I'd rather be blonde. There's some days I'd rather have your car, and there's some days I'd rather have a lot of things that, you know, could be different. But most of the time, I would not trade places with anybody else in my life, even on my bad days. And that's unbelievable for someone like me who always wanted to be someone else, look like someone else, feel like someone else, live like someone else. I mean, you know, just whatever it was. Let's see, where do I want to go now? When I was scheduled to graduate in May of 1983 from law school, in January of 1983, it became very clear that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, was dying of cancer. She was 48 years old. And in that last 5 months or whatever it was, I spent a lot of time in the hospital with Gail. And we spent a lot of time talking. It was there that I confirmed that she'd been taught to never say no. You know, that was how she became my sponsor. But anyway, and we talked about, you know, our meeting and how our friendship had evolved, you know. And when I would sit there, you know, these nurses would come in to take care of Gail and to do different things. And, you know, I didn't know any of these nurses. They certainly didn't care to meet me or whatever. But Gail never one time had anybody walk into her room that she didn't stop them and say, excuse me, Nurse Smith, I want you to meet Junie. Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney. And she would just, you know, stop these strangers who had no interest in meeting me whatsoever and tell them that. And, you know, and we talk about, you know, this is the same woman who used to say, don't sit next to me at the meeting and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor, you know. And we talked about that, you know, and Gail said, you know, June, she said, when you asked me to be your sponsor, she said, I said, yes, because I've been taught that I could not say no to an AA request. She said, but I knew with your background and your attitude, you were going absolutely nowhere. She said, but I went ahead and said yes anyway. She said, and I can remember, she said, you know, after I'd been sponsoring for you for a while, she said, you called me up and you said, I'm going to take a class, you know, at a college somewhere. She said, I knew you'd never finish. You never finished anything. I mean, you couldn't hold a job for a month at a time. I couldn't. I was incapable of it. I was just a flake in every area of my life, with the exception of my service commitments in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, you know, I didn't say anything. I knew you wouldn't finish, but I didn't say anything. And she said, and later on, after not that many classes, you called me up and you said, Gail, you know what? I think one day I want to go to law school and I want to learn how to be a lawyer. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She said, I knew you would never make it. You couldn't do it. She said, but I didn't say anything. And we talked about why she didn't say anything. And she didn't say anything, not because she believed in June, not because she ever thought June could accomplish anything, but simply because she believed in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she just didn't know what my path was going to be any more than she had known what hers was going to be. And she had seen incredible things happen in the lives of people here in Alcoholics Anonymous that really can't happen. They just can't happen. But for a power that I believe works here for me. I think that there's a power that works other places for other people, but this is where it works for me. And I'm very, very grateful that I, you know, have been able to find it. One of the things that I want to say, and you know, I don't want to be too controversial or you know anything, but I think people should probably pray more, you know. So whatever, I should too. So it's fine if I get a resentment later. But you know, the one thing I want to say is that you know my sponsor Gail was gay, and that was who she was. But I am so grateful. I think about this so often. I am so grateful that Gail went to meetings outside of meetings where only gay people went. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, when it talks about people who would normally not mix, it means so much in my life that Gail was a part of it. And I might not have met her, you know, and I might not have met a lot of other people who mean so much to me. You know, if we get too sequestered, you know, into a certain type of group. And I'm not saying that there isn't a reason for those groups. I know that there is, because there are those groups, and we need them, you know. Just as we need young people's groups, I believe, and we need the different types of groups that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's why I believe that we have them. But I just want to ask all of you, you know, to please remember that we're people who normally would not mix, you know, and you may be the person to change someone else's life, even if they don't have the same lifestyle, you know, that you may choose to have right now or that I may choose to have. One of my closest friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who's been here at your conference also was Patty Hicks. And Patty Hicks and I got sober in 1972. And, you know, we were a lot alike in our attitudes. We both had bad ones, and we both did speak the same language, so that made it kind of fun. Patty was about the age of my mom, maybe a little tiny bit younger, though, and I was about the age of one of her daughters, although I was a little bit younger as well. And I believe that the process of my friendship with Patty Hicks was what was to allow me eventually to have a relationship with my mother. I learned through Patty, being a woman mother alcoholic, that there were a lot of things that she didn't want to have happen out there. And it began to clear a path for me for forgiveness. And by the time I was about 7 years sober, my mother gave me a cake in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that time, I realized that had it not been for the hell and the pain and the abuse that went along with my mother's alcoholism, I might not have found Alcoholics Anonymous at the time that I did. And so I began to be able to be grateful not only for my own alcoholism, but for my mother's and the way that it was, you know, the path that it was to lead us on. With Patty, we had a lot of laughs and we had a lot of fun. And Patty was able to do a lot of things for me, as was Gail. You know, and I can remember telling Gail, you know, it made me so upset that at 10 years sober, I was still not able to put a dollar in the basket. You know, that I was still so poor that I would come home from meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and people would have left a bag of groceries on my front porch. And I really felt like a failure a lot of the time, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wasn't able to contribute, you know, financially. And Patty bought me a lot of clothes, and Gail bought me a lot of clothes, you know. And I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe 15 years sober. Before, I wasn't wearing someone else's underwear, someone else's bra, someone else's shoes, someone else's pants, someone else's shirt, someone else's, you know, whatever. I mean, that was just the best that I could do. And I would, you know, I would say to Gail, I'd say, Jesus, Gail, when is it going to be my turn to give back? How come I can't do that? You know, and she would say, you know what, we don't get to give back to the same people who gave to us. You know, and a lot of times we don't even get to pay back the same way that they paid to us. And I don't like that. I like to stay even and about 25 cents ahead. And so it was a very hard thing. I can remember one year for Patty, I had a friend who had a Gucci box. And I thought, oh, Patty would get, I wish I could get Patty something at Gucci. I'd heard about it from Patty. I'd never been there. But anyway, so I asked my friend if I could have the box. She said, sure, you can have it. So I took the box and I wrote a little note. I said, Dear Patty, Merry Christmas. You told me it's the thought that counts. At least my thoughts are expensive. Love, Jim. And this was going to be her Christmas present. Patty had talked at this one meeting down in, I think it's Long Beach. I don't remember, but it's somewhere down south. I was just there, and that's how I remembered it. And it's this, I think it's a Monday night or whatever, it's this meeting. When they do birthday cakes, which we do in California, they have these popper things, those 99-cent poppers or whatever, you know. So when they give the birthday cake a happy birthday to, you know, whatever, then they do these poppers. But Patty didn't know this was going to happen, you know. So she's like sitting there, and all of a sudden these poppers are going just, ah, you know, these poppers. And it's just, you know. But she told me about it when she came home. She said, this was so cool. There was confetti everywhere, and it was just like really this element of surprise. And, you know, it was just so pretty. So I got a popper to open, you know, to set off when she opened her gift, my note that I gave her. So I set off my popper, and she opened her box, and she was reading the note, and all of a sudden she screamed because I had just set her floor-to-ceiling drapes on fire with the popper. And so Patty was out without drapes for like 3 years. But, you know, We were just friends, part of each other's lives, you know. And Patty died in 1988 of a brain tumor. And, you know, we had stood up together every year at my home group, you know, for our birthday. And so I stood up at Sweet 16 without Patty, and it was really, really hard. And I still really miss her a lot. You know, I just think that I really do feel, though, that even though I've suffered some of these losses, that I've been so lucky to have these people in my life for the time that I was able to have them. I guess I'll talk about, you know, one other area, and then I'm going to sit down. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was single. And I think today, if you're 13, that's a good idea. But when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't so sure. You know, I had... my mom had never been married, and I was convinced that, you know, things would have been a lot different if she had. And so I had this sort of idea that marriage would solve a lot of problems or something, you know, like a fairy tale thing or whatever. I don't know exactly. But, you know, so I really, 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 really wanted to be in a relationship. I've learned a lot over the years. I mean, I was in this, you know... I was in my first relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were together for about 2.5 years, which sounds almost successful in a bizarre way, but we really never stayed together 30 consecutive days. I mean, we never took a chip, you know, without him breaking up with me. Because, you know, he'd had an affair with someone else and he'd make an amends. And, you know, it was a very spiritual thing. and Gail had a very strong opinion about this relationship, and it was not favorable. But anyway, when I was going out with this guy, in 2.5 years, he never bought me dinner. He never bought me a present. We would go to meetings, and he would go in, and I had to wait outside 15 minutes before I was allowed to come in, and then I was supposed to pretend like I didn't know him. And if I was at his house and someone came over, I'd go hide in the closet until they left. And you might think I'm taking, you know, his inventory as I say these things, but, you know, what I want to tell you is that I felt lucky. I was so grateful, you know, that he would let me hide in his closet. You know, I just, I thought, wow, you know, things are really looking up. And when he would break up with me, I would think of the thing that I had always thought about from the time that I was 5 years old, which was suicide. And at a certain point in sobriety, it became so painful that I really did not think I could stay sober without killing myself. And I had never dealt with those kind of feelings or any kind of feelings or pain. I mean, I just took something so quick I didn't have to. And it was very, very painful. And I can remember one night I was in the bathroom and thinking about, you know, cutting my wrists, and there was a knock at my door. And I went and I opened the door, and there was this guy named Bob. I go, "How you doing, Bob?" And he said, "Oh, fine." He says, "You remember you said you'd told you central office needed some people to go over to this college and talk a little bit about, you know, AA, and you said that you'd go with me tonight." I said, "Listen, Bob, experience, strength, and hope I really don't have right now. I was just going to go in the bathroom and kill myself." And he said, "Oh." He said, "Have you had dinner?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go get something to eat. We'll go over to the school thing." He said, "You don't have to say anything. You know, I could see you're upset." He said, "And then I'll bring you home and you can kill yourself." And I thought, all right. You know, I made a commitment. I told him I'd go. So we drove along. And, you know, as we drove, I wouldn't let Bob talk to me. And I wouldn't let him play the radio. Because, you know, if you talk to someone or you turn the radio on or you do something, you could get distracted. And if you do that, you're going to miss out on some of the pain. Because if you're going to feel all the pain, you definitely have to focus. And, you know, I not only was feeling the pain of this loss, but if you're going to feel the maximum amount of pain, you have to concentrate on the fact that there will never be anyone else again. Otherwise, you're not really at the point that you can get to. So I was working my way there. And we eventually pulled up at this school, and we were walking along, and I was deep in thought. And this woman came up to me, and she said, "Excuse me, do you know where room, you know, 315 is?" And I said, "No." I give very short answers when I'm in pain because I want to get back to thinking about me. And she said, "Well, could you help me find it?" I thought, all right. So I started wandering around. I got her lost, and she started talking. She said, "I'm here taking a drama class." She goes, "Well, what are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I came with some people, and, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know." She said, "Really?" She said, "I'm on the wagon." I said, "That's great." So I've known a lot of people on the wagon. They usually fall off. I said, "But that's nice." She said, "Well, why would you be giving that kind of a talk?" I said, "Well, because I'm an alcoholic, and I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime?" And she said, yeah, she would, and we traded phone numbers, made arrangements to go to a meeting the next night. Obviously, I couldn't kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. So I took her to lots and lots of meetings, and she did not stay sober at that time. Although this coming August, I think Kay will celebrate 24 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she has every bit as much to do with my still being sober today as I had anything to do with her being sober. But anyway, I learned from that what it says in the big book, which is when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. And that has saved my life on more than one occasion. I finally realized that, you know, part of the problem that I had in relationships was that I sort of had this attitude, like I'd get, you know, I'd meet somebody and I'd kind of do this thing like, okay, I don't like you. I don't care about you. And it doesn't really matter to me whether you live or die. Okay, but we can like be together. Okay, and then, you know, what I was waiting for was for them to say, you know, I really care about you. I have really strong feelings for you, and I'd really like to spend the rest of my life with you. And I'd say, yeah, me too. That's really what I meant, you know. But there's this funny little secret that I want to tell you about in case you don't know this. When you're, like, putting out there, you know what, I don't care about you, you don't matter, and nothing is important, and it doesn't matter to me whether you live or die, people almost never come up and say, I care about you, and I'd really like to spend my life with you. You know, so I'm just going to share that with you because it was a surprise to me that that was part of the problem that I was having. Anyway, I eventually, when I was in law school, this guy asked me out, and I didn't really want to go out with him because he had not been in prison. He didn't have any tattoos. I just wasn't sure we'd have enough in common, you know, to talk about things, you know, or whatever. But I finally ended up going out with him, and we went out for quite a while. And after we graduated from law school, we decided to get married. And in November of 1988, we got married. And when we did, every member of my family was there. Every member of my family that was there, with the exception of three people, I had to pay money to be able to be there. Two people in my family came from another country who'd never been in this family to represent my grandparents. You know, of course, lots and lots of my very special, you know, AA family and friends were there. And my husband's entire family was there as well. And, you know, as I walked down that aisle, I didn't wish I was marrying anybody else. I didn't wish I was wearing somebody else's dress. I didn't wish I was, you know, wearing somebody else's shoes. And I was wearing shoes, by the way. You know, I didn't wish I was doing anything different, you know. I was just really, really grateful to be right where I was. And it was one of those moments, you know, where it just really felt good and right. And it was a very, very special day for me. I had never wanted to have children. And there were a lot of reasons why I didn't. And I also had been told from the time that I first got sober in the early years of my sobriety, I had many, many surgeries. I had some severe physical problems, and I was told by the time that I was 15 that I needed to have a hysterectomy. And then it was just a question of waiting until I was 18 when a doctor would do it and when I'd have insurance so that I could pay for it. And so I really didn't believe that I would ever be able to have children. And I think, you know, again, the way that I hated myself so much that I couldn't even imagine the idea of bringing someone in the world who might remotely look like me or something. So that was just, you know, not a possibility for me. But after we had been married for a while, my husband, actually, I mean, we talked about it before I got married. But anyway, my husband really wanted to try and have a child. And so we did try, and I ended up, I did have to get some fertility help, and we didn't think it was really going to happen. And then and I had a miscarriage, and then I did end up getting pregnant. And I had a little girl named Samantha. And Samantha was just 8 this month. And about 6 months after Samantha was born, maybe 7 months, I wasn't feeling very well. I went to the doctor, you know, to figure out what this flu was that I had, and it turned out that I was pregnant. And we were all very surprised. And the doctor said it was, you know, kind of what they call Irish twins, you know, when you have kids that close together. But anyway, I then had my daughter, Jessica. And not too long after, a couple years actually after that, I had a few more miscarriages, and then I had my daughter Cassandra, and I have these three little girls, and you know, people all the time come up and say, you know, gosh, they look so much like you. I mean, those would have been fighting words, you know, years ago. And I'm like, yeah, they're pretty cute. You know, it's really fun. I mean, you know, anybody who's ever had kids or been around kids knows that, you know, it can be interesting and wonderful and hard. You know, I mean, there are times, like, you know, if my kids were people I sponsored, I might tell them, you know, you need to work with someone else for a while because, hey, you know. But we don't get to do that. So anyway, I want to tell you a couple of stories really quick about my kids, and then I'm going to sit down. A couple of years ago, Samantha and I, we were all moving, and we were moving from this place where I had this tree. I mean, it was this 45-year-old tree that the people who had owned this house before we did had planted. And it was the biggest, most beautiful tree I've ever seen, you know, in my life. I mean, you know, to have. It was just unbelievable. And I loved this tree. And I was very, very, very sad about moving from my tree. And I was outside, and Samantha was about five, and she was sitting next to me, and I was starting to, you know, kind of cry, and, you know, and I just said, I'm just going to miss the tree, Sam. I really love the tree, and, you know, there'll be other trees, and, you know, she said, well, Mommy, maybe it's time for another family to get to have this tree. You know, and I thought, God, you know, I guess I should ask her to be my sponsor, you know. Anyway, I have this book, you know, of, it's not a meditation book, but I mean, it's an AA, you know, book, literature book that they read, you know, that has those daily things. And I read an Al-Anon one too, actually. And I'm not really sure which book this was in, but anyway, I like to read these books, and I'm really into like stories. Because, I mean, that's part of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, you know, is the stories, they, like, come up in my life, you know, later on. I mean, like, someone says to me, do you know Joe? I'll go, I don't know. You know, and they'll say, you know Joe, he had the Doberman that drank his vodka, and then they played basketball. I was like, Joe, yeah, I know Joe. Okay, so that's sort of how stories work for me. And they work for me when I'm, like, in the middle of, you know, like, having a hard time. You know, I remember Hal Marley saying, you know, while you're waiting for the elevator, this is a chance for spiritual time. You know, it'll, like, come to me, you know. Anyway, so I'm not always happy about the thoughts that come. But anyway, a lot of them are like these funny little stories. But anyway, so I'm reading this one thing one day, and it's about Gandhi. And Gandhi was with a bunch of his followers, and he was running to catch a train. And as he had to jump to catch the train because the train was taking off, one of his sandals got caught in the track and fell off. And as soon as he got on the train, he stood up and he reached down and he took off his other sandal and he threw it back. And some of his followers said, Gandhi, why did you do that? He said, because, you know, if there was one sandal there, it wouldn't be of any benefit to anybody. But maybe if someone comes along, they might find a pair. Now, I don't remember what day of the week or what day of the month or whatever that was, but I mean, I have thought about that story in so many contexts. You know, like when I lose an earring, okay? I'm thinking, where is that earring? I'm thinking, all right, now, am I really willing to just throw the other earring out there so someone can? I was like, no, I want my earring. You know what I mean? I'm like working on this, but I mean, it just amazes me that Gandhi could even think about this. And plus, I wouldn't think of it till like, you know, like 9 months later. I think, all right, I guess I should have left the other earring. I mean, they might as well have a pair, you know. So I mean, how he thought of this, just like that. So anyway, about 3 months ago, I'm picking up my daughter Jessica, and we go running from, you know, for the car because we're going somewhere fast, and we're jumping into my giant truck. And I open the door for her, and she climbs into the truck, and her shoe falls off, you know, in the street. So she goes, Mom, I dropped my shoe. I go, Jessie! You know, so I bend over to, you know, to pick it up, and I look, and it's fallen in the storm drain. I mean, like, 6 feet down, you know? And I go, Jessie, it's way down there. And she goes, should I throw the other one down there, Mom? About that story I read. You know what I mean? I'm living with Gandhi. So, anyway, I want to thank you all for allowing me to be a part of your weekend. Norm Alpe was one of the old-timers that was here when I got sober, and he had one of the most powerful messages I've ever heard. He was one of the most enthusiastic members of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever known. Every time I ever heard Norm Alpe speak, I would think, I want to join AA, and then I'd remember I already belong. That's why I was there hearing him. But he was just unbelievable, you know, and one of the things that Norm Alpe talked a lot about was he would say, you know what, but for the grace of God, rooms like this and people like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks for not letting me.